Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump, on the occasion of signing an executive order on transparency, has recast his position a little bit. There's no inconsistency here, basically following up on the letter that was sent to House Democrat leaders from his White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. President Trump yesterday saying, look, if the House Democrats want to play fair, want to abide historical standards when it comes to impeachment inquiries, then, you know, then I'm happy to be as cooperative as I can be.
If Pelosi holds a vote on the floor on impeachment and commits to the rules of previous impeachment proceedings, you'll participate in that investigation?
Yeah, if the rules are fair, because I don't know exactly your definition.
Yeah, if the rules are fair. So, for example, the reporter asking if Pelosi were to have a formal House vote on the impeachment inquiry such that if they move to do so, which they would, it would be referred to the Judiciary Committee as the point, and Republicans would have subpoena power so they could meaningfully participate in this investigation in a more public way. So there's an openness there. And I mean, you know, this is in part a perception battle with respect to popular support for impeachment or a popular opposition to it. I note Dan Henninger's column in The Wall Street Journal today. He writes, historians may muse one day on what it would have been like if the press had chosen in January of 2017 to cover Donald Trump's presidency, however unruly, as a matter of expectably intense policy disputes, rather than launch a permanent takedown project. For now, get a helmet, World War Trump is on, suggesting that this presidency is effectively over, and what you have is a pitched battle like you have experienced over the last 3 weeks that will take place over the next 13 months.
Hmm. Well, one person who came forward yesterday demanding Trump's impeachment has remained pretty silent on the matter. Joe Biden finally committed, Dan, the bravery to come forward.
He should be impeached. He's shooting holes in the Constitution, and we cannot let him get away with it.
So ridiculous.
Well, they're all being forced to fall in line with the House. There's no leadership coming from the Democrat Socialist candidates for president, including Biden. It's all follow the leader being Nancy Pelosi, and the backbenchers in the House.
And she's not leading. I mean, she doesn't want to file impeachment inquiry or take a vote on the House floor because she doesn't want to jeopardize districts where, you know, people voted for President Trump.
Well, perhaps. We'll see. I think, again, Henninger's analysis, I think, is pretty accurate. Trump is basically making the argument to the public. I mean, this might as well be October of 2020, because you're not going to hear a lot different, I suspect. You may not like me, but you have to vote for me to save your 401k. Against Ms. Warren, whose plans are virtually alien to the economic growth, this is a plausible strategy. For Democrats, impeaching Trump is just one big bomb and a larger strategy for the long march back to power next year. Their plan is to make the country's political life so intolerable that the American people simply run up the white flag on the Trump presidency, no mas. The base, Trump's base, will never surrender. The Democrats aren't targeting them, of course. They're targeting that squishy 10 to 15%. In the expectation these voters will decide that making accommodations between policy and personality has become impossible, and that 4 more years of this would be too much to endure, even accepting 401k losses as the price of deliverance. That, too, Henninger suggests, is a plausible strategy. I tell you, I don't disagree with Henninger's analysis. You know, the idea that people simply vote in a tunnel-like fashion for their economic interests, well, that just runs afoul of electoral results at every level over the history of our little experiment in representative Republican government. So the idea that you may not wear President Trump down, you may not exhaust him mentally or physically, but could you exhaust enough passively engaged voters who are otherwise commonsensical but just want it to stop and say, well, maybe somebody new will be different. And somebody new, whoever they nominate, would be different. Not different good, but different. Dave and Racine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Just wondering if Trump calling for an investigation into Joe Biden is interfering with the election. Isn't Joe Biden calling for the impeachment of Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for president, interfering with the election?
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Dave. Yes, interference is sort of an eye of the beholder accusation, isn't it? But with respect to the Trump administration, you have everybody falling in line with the posture that the White House has taken. We're not going to cooperate if you're not going to abide the sort of precedent on impeachment. We don't, the Wall Street Journal editorial board writing, we don't recall Democrats fretting when Mr. Clinton made executive privilege claims that were more sweeping than Nixon's during Watergate. The media now profess horror at Mr. Trump raised not a whim of concern when AG Eric Holder denied documents to Congress and was held in contempt. Just politics, they said then. Now, in their hatred of Mr. Trump, they dilate about constitutional norms they ignore when it suits them politically, of course. Right. Hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. As La Rochefoucauld said, but Russ Vaught, OMB director, other senior-level individuals in the Trump administration, they're on board with the president and his perspective on impeachment.
No, yesterday's letter speaks for itself. We're not going to be a part of any sham process that's designed to relitigate the last election. When the American people spoke very clearly and soundly in saying that they want President Trump to be their president, and that's now being used to influence the next election. We wake up every morning trying to accomplish the objectives.
Yeah, so not going to relitigate 16 and not going to use this to participate in using this to frame 2020. Related story, VP Pence saying yesterday he is working with the White House Counsel's Office to release transcripts of his own calls with Ukrainian President Zelensky. There's two phone conversations that Pence had with Zelensky that he suggests would actually help the cause of President Trump in characterizing the White House's position vis-a-vis Ukraine. So we'll look forward to more phone call transcripts as, like sands through the hourglass, these are the days of our impeachment.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Ronan Farrow, he the journalist, I suppose, most responsible for ushering in the Me Too era.
It's all him, baby.
He has a new book out called Catch and Kill. A number of revelations from the book. The one that was being most reported yesterday, of course, was a rape allegation against former Today Show host Matt Lauer.
Yeah, he apparently, when he was at the Sochi Olympics, he was with one of Meredith Vieira's producers. And one night, they were at the hotel bar, and she and Meredith were having a drink. Matt Lauer walked by. He sat down, had drinks with them. Meredith left. Those two, she said she did 6 shots of vodka. And then went back to his hotel room, not once, but twice. First time to get her press pass. Second time, she said he cornered her in the room. He had on a T-shirt and boxers, threw her on the bed, did inappropriate things that I don't know if we can even discuss.
He raped her.
He raped her, but
that's the allegation.
He raped her anally. and she was said she was crying soft. Well, it's, you know, he Kobe Bryant-ed her. Sorry. That's what Kobe Bryant allegedly did to that woman in Denver who worked at the hotel there. She said she was quietly crying in her pillow, and she was bleeding for days. And
Brooke Nevels is her name.
Yes.
Now, Matt Lauer has responded to that allegation. The story Brooke Nevels tells is filled with false details intended only to create impression that this was an abusive encounter. He also is, so he denies the entire thing, and she apparently said that they did have a transactional sexual relationship after this alleged rape.
Yeah, but she said that he was in the position of power and that she was so drunk, Dan, that she didn't consent to have sex that night. But she did the other nights. So I have two problems with the story. That, the fact that she continued to have a relationship with him, where, you know, people screamed at me yesterday, like, Amy, she did that because he was in the position of power and she was fearful of losing her job.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't work for Matt Lauer. She didn't work for the Today Show. She worked for Meredith Vieira.
He also said there are a number of Matt Lauer erroneous reports associated with him, including there was not the infamous button in his office that could lock the door from the inside. There was no such locking mechanism. It didn't exist.
Boo, I love that part.
Well,
I mean, we were making fun of that part of the story yesterday, that, and I thought that was widely known throughout NBC that he could lock the door from a button underneath his desk.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, Ronan Farrow may be fielding his own litigation if what Matt Lauer is suggesting is true. He said in this open letter to Ronan Farrow and the world, my silence has been a mistake. Nearly 2 years after I was fired by NBC, old stories are being recycled, titling details being added, and a dangerous and defamatory, ding, 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 that's a word of litigation, new allegation is being made. All are being spread as part of a promotional effort to sell a book. It's outrageous. So after not speaking out to protect my children, it's now with their full support, I say enough.
He also went on to say there was absolutely nothing aggressive about that encounter that she claims where he raped her. Brooke did not do or say anything to object. She certainly did not cry. She was a fully enthusiastic and willing partner.
Yeah, and he goes into great detail in terms of all the kind of relations they had, which I'll spare you. I'm having a very difficult time caring about Matt Lauer. I don't like people being wrongly accused. I don't like people who are victimized not getting justice either. But I just have a very difficult time caring about these people. Now, that separates me from Hillary Clinton, who does care about these people. One of the other bombshells in Ronan Farrow's book is that Hillary Clinton cares. There's no question. She cares about Harvey Weinstein. We learned that...
don't tell me she had a Me Too movement.
Moment
with Harvey Weinstein.
No.
All right.
Weinstein moved to leverage his relationship with Hillary Clinton. He basically worked through her PR flax to have them fish for information from Farrow about the story. Nick Merrill, Hillary Clinton's publicist, told him that the big story Farrow was working on was, quote, a concern for us, unquote. He also called Farrow's estranged father, that would be Woody Allen, to solicit advice. And Woody Allen said, I'm so sorry, I have none. Good luck to you. Hillary Clinton, I'm with her. Well, she was with Harvey, according to Ronan Farrow. Just want to note that for the record. Perhaps she could be asked about it when she's at the Pickwick Theater.
Tomorrow,
yeah. Yeah, in Park Ridge, hanging out with the old homies. Maybe somebody in Park Ridge could ask her about the Ronan Farrow book. Wouldn't that be fun?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
By the way, nice use of the word ancillary.
Oh, can we put that on a magnet? Words with Amy?
On AM 560.
Your magnet will be Word with Amy.
The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The leafy village of Oak Park, arguably the home of Ernest Hemingway. Arguably.
Yes.
Cicero still claims Hemingway, too. Big, always a fight over Hemingway.
Really?
The nuclear free zone Park.
Oh, thank goodness.
You're not allowed to either possess nuclear weapons or deploy them.
Oh,
in Oak Park. They passed passed a resolution. And that's
wondering that, where there's that's I was going to store those nuclear rods, Dan.
That's controlling. That is controlling. Yep, you're going to have to put your plutonium elsewhere.
Remember when they wanted to give people a ticket for eating in their car? Remember that was out of Oak Park.
So many great moments in Oak Park Village government history. Here's another one. Meet Susan Buchanan. Ooh, boy. Cinch it up and hunker down. At Oak Park trustee at a village board meeting, trustee Susan Buchanan got after some of her fellow board members on the topics of racial equity and oppression. Earlier this year, the Oak Park Community Relations Commission recommended amendments to its diversity statement. Could you think of a less interesting way to spend your life? No.
I'm sorry.
At the May 29th meeting, the trustees tabled the discussion.
Oh, okay.
But
don't hold your breath.
It was revived for the most recent meeting. And this is how that went. Susan Buchanan is the one you hear sort of dominating the discussion and, frankly, eliminating any discussion.
Yeah,
I don't want to hear what you have to say.
Oh, my gosh.
No, come I'm on. Serious. Susan, Jim, why do you have an opinion on this?
Come on, Susan. Susan, this is... I won't say a word.
That's why I like to...
You shouldn't have an opinion on that.
I met with constituents of color, and quite honestly, some of the feedback was that some of this wording was ridiculous.
From birth, you have been white from birth. Why are you arguing what is a system of oppression? You've never experienced one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So shut up. I don't want to hear from you. Okay. Just stop, Dan. Stop. Dino, you are not oppressed, and people in Oak Park are, and we are trying to recognize that as a community.
Mm-hmm.
This mayor and this board is obviously not willing to face history. We have a chance to make history. It is time for this community to face equity enough. And you stop it. You are a white male. Stop it. You are a white male. Your skin is light enough. Stop it.
I got to look. I think if we reduce these conversations to nobody cares what you have to say because you're a white male, I don't think we're doing this right.
That was Village Trustee Dan Maroney at the end. Dan Maroney was subsequently executed after the meeting.
Stop it. No. Well, Susan Buchanan, she's white, but she's down with the struggle because her husband appears to be African-American and they have a child together.
Mm. That's
from what I'm learning online.
That's here. Dr. Susan Buchanan to you.
Oh, excuse me, Missy.
What a fun bedside manner she has. She began her career in family practice, apparently. But then later lost her mind at some point and became this individual that you've just heard. She spent the last 15 years, according to her CV, helping vulnerable workers by improving health and safety on the job, has become an expert on the health effects of environmental pollutants. Oh, I bet.
And my eyes roll over. Okay.
Mm-hmm. She is an attending physician and clinical associate professor of occupational and environmental health sciences at UIC's Health and Hospital System and School of Public Health. Yeah. Another feather in the cap for UIC, just when you thought Bill Ayers was their most renowned professor emeritus, you get to meet Susan Buchanan. Shut up. You're a white man. You can't talk. I mean, by the way.
And she's pointing his finger. If you see the video, too, she's pointing like, shut up. You're a white guy.
I don't know what the political dispositions of any of the other trustees. I can't imagine they're particularly conservative. It is Oak Park. But that was a bold statement that Trustee Dan Maroney made, right? If you can't say anything because you're a white man, maybe we're not doing this right. Huh. What do you think about that? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-366-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The kind of hysterics that you see on the streets of Portland or on your local college campus are not limited to those places. How many times have we said on this show what we talk about in one locale or in one setting, they are coming to a village government, to a corporate boardroom, to a K-12 school system, to a downtown business district near you. Meet Dr. Susan Buchanan, who is ready to sacrifice herself for black and brown people on the pyre of the village's diversity statement.
What is that even? I mean, what is the diversity statement?
Don't care. The more important.
I mean,
the
does
more
care?
Important.
Does that, you think anybody takes yeah. time to read a village's diversity statement? I didn't even know they had such things.
Forget reading it. What does it do?
What does it mean?
What does it accomplish? How does that uplift black and brown people who were arguably oppressed, depending on what exactly we're talking about and which group we're exactly talking about? I tell you, it's really remarkable, too. It's such a bastardization of the history of black Americans, which is a history of resilience and achievement. But Susan Buchanan doesn't want to talk about that. And neither do any of the other race racketeers. The history of black achievement and resilience in the face of pernicious institutions like slavery and Jim Crow. So I guess my question to Susan Buchanan, I mean, I wouldn't be allowed to ask it because I'm a white man. I would probably suffer the fate of Dan Maroney, be sent to, you know, Oak Park Diversity Jail. But what are we here to try to do? We can't undo what happened. So the wounds from what happened, are we trying to heal them and point a way towards inspiration and a better model for success and achievement and enjoyment of life? Or are we to wallow in the sins of the past that we cannot undo? What's more productive? Endless diversity statements from village governments, or educating people about the history they don't know, just speaking about black Americans as an example, the history they don't know of achievement and resilience, and pointing away to young black people, boys and girls, and K-12, and higher ed, young professionals, saying, you're part of a heritage that overcame so much to achieve so much. There's nothing you can't achieve.
Well, on her website, her platform, Racial Equity, she says that many people of color feel that this village is not for them. And she wants the village board to play a role in assuring that Oak Park Village is a place where people of color can thrive.
Yes, Oak Park, socialist paradise. Boy,
mission statement.
It's not that they don't feel comfortable in Oak Park. I don't know. I mean, I don't know that any person who doesn't enjoy being screeched at would be comfortable in Oak Park with Susan Buchanan roaming around. She's unhinged.
She said that we should actively seek out and recruit minority residents.
Yeah. During a public comment section, the public comment segment of the meeting, there was a response to Susan Buchanan.
No, I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the fuck is going on. But I think white women started it. It's the worst. The fucking worst. It's all they do is bitch, moan, and complain. I had no idea how difficult it was to be a white woman in the United States of America. Evidently, it's really difficult.
Mm-hmm. The white women he was talking about, Bill yes. Burr, of course, Susan Buchanan. That's what he's talking about. The self-appointed spokeswoman for black and brown people, by the way, which is center cut for the suburban, insufferable suburban Champagne socialist. Center cut, Susan Buchanan is, for that slice of life. Robert in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I grew up in Oak Park. My mom still lives in Oak Park. Oak Park has always, you know, helped a lot of my friends in high school, African-American. And most of them weren't from Oak Park. They were from Austin. They were allowed to come into the Oak Park school system.
There was just a series on OPRF on, you know, one of the cable channels, and it was all done by the documentarians who did Hoop Dreams, right? And it was all race-based, and it was all focused on the African-American students, at least their perspective, as well as some individual students, and the administrators, mostly black administrators, at OPR at Oak Park River Forest. I mean, it's just so tiresome. There's no even purpose attempting to address anything on the merits with the Susan Buchanans of the world, but you can use her as the bad example to actually address things on the merit the way, say, a Bob Woodson or other people who actually led the civil rights movement know something about the full story with respect to black history in America and are looking to inspire and empower and animate poor people across the spectrum, but no, particularly black Americans. Where Susan Buchanan is content to screech about a freaking diversity statement and pretend like she's doing something. I'm sorry, Robert. Go ahead.
Well, real quick, if they want to have more African-Americans come into Oak Park, my mom's 87 years old. Her house is worth about $350,000, and she pays $15,800 a year in property taxes.
Ouch.
Okay, so if they want to make more people be able to come to Oak Park, you might want to lower
your property
how much taxes you charge.
Yeah, right.
Per house.
Yeah, nice try. Thanks for the call,
Robert.
I hope
your mom
gets
a senior exemption.
Yeah. The blank check for OPRF, I'm sorry, if you don't agree to the blank check for the schools, then you're racist. But if you make it such that nobody can make any money on their home, or nobody with any sort of economic sense would want to buy a home that comes attached with that property tax liability, then you're racist. No matter what you do, you're racist with Susan Buchanan at the helm. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. I think the liberal mind rot has taken firm hold in the MD's brain. I would encourage her to get a CAT scan or something like that to see if there's any functioning brain cells left. Mm. You know, the problem is that the whole people of color thriving, why not just people thriving? Why can't we start thinking about creating all places where people live in America as places where all of us can thrive? Lower taxes, fair taxes, eliminating these ridiculous morons running these towns. But here's the problem, Dan and Amy. The only way to get the Susan Buchanans of the world shut up is by responsible people saying, who is this idiot screeching at the public and running for these positions and booting butts like hers out of those chairs?
Thanks, Ralph. Daniel in Algonquin.
Yeah, hi. You know, segregation has always been the progressive mindset. And this is proven time and time again, all the way back to Woodrow Wilson. So now we're dealing with the neo-segregation where, and if you're not this tribe, you can't have a voice. You have no relevance to the issue.
Thanks for the call, Daniel.
What happened to you today, sweetheart? Huh? Did they not chill your rosé? You know? Was the trolley not running down at the mall? What happened? No, it's unreal. I'm really fucking annoyed how white women have the fucking balls to throw my white privilege in my face, you know? Sort of separate themselves from these white males with their white male privilege. It's like, bitch, you're sitting in the jacuzzi with me. The fuck are you talking about?
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
top of the morning. Dan and Amy, of the roughly, 300 players in the NBA? Anybody have a count on how many have tweeted in support of Hong Kongans and their pursuit of freedom?
Let me see. Oh, no, I don't think of one.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think they're still trying to figure it out. They're waiting in line to talk to Steve Kerr's brother-in-law about Chinese history. Steph Curry, who plays for Steve Kerr and the Golden State Warriors, you know, league MVP.
We're very familiar with his work, yes.
He was asked about Steve Kerr's comments.
Oh, boy.
As well as Trump's tweet on the subject, going after both Kerr and San Antonio Spurs coach Greg Popovich for being the cowards that they are.
Steph, obviously the largest story in the league right now is what's going on in NBA in China. I'm sure you were just told about Trump going off on Steve for what he said. What are just kind of your general thoughts on this entire kind of saga at this point?
I just heard about the Trump thing. I got to welcome Steve to the club. First and foremost, that's kind of par for the course there. We've obviously been really outspoken over the since I can remember in terms of our organization and all that, but from the other league in China and just our presence there, the way that we've been building a business, it's an interesting situation because there's so much history involved in it, and I don't know that history well enough to kind of speak on it or form an opinion yet. So that's kind of where I'm at with the situation. But,
I don't know the history. Yeah.
Obviously, I know following up to date with how the league's handling it, you know, Adam Silver and the reaction within China. So, I'm staying tuned like everybody else.
Staying tuned.
You know, it's interesting. It's so singularly focused on Hong Kong and the protests there, the democracy protesters there. I want some enterprising reporter in sports media, which, as I always point out, just an extension of the Beltway Press Corps, meaning left. Some enterprising reporter might ask him about the stories of the day. You don't even have to know your last 7 years of Chinese history. How about stories of the day, like this one? Despite Chinese officials' repeated claim that internment camps filled mostly with ethnic Uyghurs are vocational education centers, Uyghur Muslims who actually survived the camp say that inmates were beaten and killed. Since April 2017, up to 2 million members of China's predominantly Muslim minority Uyghur ethnic group have been imprisoned in camps in northwest China's Xinjiang province. The Chinese officials, meaning communists, arguing the camps are necessary for de-radicalizing extremists, comparing them to the counterterrorism measures taken by the United States. Oh, sure, I remember when we rounded up all the Muslims in America after 9/11 and put them in internment camps to de-radicalize them. Yeah, real comparable. Comparable to counterterrorism measures in the United States. Absurd. Of course it's absurd. Why can't anybody in the NBA say that? Oh, because you're getting a paycheck. Steph Curry came as close as I've heard any NBA player to a bout with honesty when he said, yeah, it's sort of interesting given the business relationship. Yeah. Just say, look, beyond my pay grade, I understand I'm a little chastened by making easy pronouncements about politics that are popular in my little bubble. And then when it comes to my pocketbook concerns, I'm willing to walk away from the sort of human rights abuses that are not close calls. How about something like that? And the question I have, too, I mean, I remember the reaction from many to Colin Kaepernick and some of the NFL players taking a knee. What about the NBA? From Adam Silver to the coaches to some of the players, this flacking for Chinese communist killers. How will that sit with you as it pertains to patronizing the NBA? Either going to Bulls games, watching it on TV, going to Bucks games to see Anacumpo over up there in Milwaukee. He's a great player.
Yeah. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick question. My point of contention is, even if you bring in, as an American citizen, and you go to a preseason NBA game, like this one kid did, he went to the Washington Wizards game, actually they're playing a Chinese pro team, but he's on American soil, brings in a free Hong Kong poster, gets kicked out.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the performances of our national anthem, and please welcome Andrea Renee Rillio.
So he gets kicked out.
Same thing happened in Philly.
I know. It's just
same thing will happen in any Brooklyn Nets game that's owned by one of the co-founders of Alibaba, who has already suggested that the Hong Kong protester issue is the third rail, meaning don't talk about it.
And speaking of the Brooklyn Nets, they're playing the LA Lakers in China, and the preseason, you know, interviews were canceled, or the pregame interviews were canceled. Postgame interviews are going to be canceled, and Adam Silver was supposed to speak, and the Chinese government put the kibosh on that too.
Close call here. It's complicated, tricky. More stories in real time. Chinese Communist Party has raised dozens of Uyghur Muslim cemeteries in western Xinjiang province to create more quote-unquote civilized areas. Oh. Uyghur locals and activists accusing the Chinese Communists of attempting to erase the ethnic minority's history and uproot them from their ancestral home, because they are. Chinese media and NBA scandal. The Hong Kong riots are just like 9/11. You Americans, one tweet... to give you a flavor of some of the agitprop coming from the Chinese communists and their apparatchiks. You Americans don't know what's going on in China and just talk about freedom. So 9/11 was about freedom, too. That's the same thing. You talk about freedom, then you're forcing Clippers owners Donald Sterling to sell his team. He also has freedom of speech. Uh-huh. The Global Times reporting that some of the messages comparing making the 9/11 comparison were real. A few angry Chinese netizens online said 9/11 is a beautiful date for the U.S. After all, freedom of speech. Freedom of speech. Flying planes into buildings. Yeah, gosh, I'm sorry you can't distinguish that. I suppose that's a tricky issue, too. Real tricky to try to defend the indefensible. It is. Greg Popovich tried. San Antonio Spurs coach, who's even more intolerable and ignorant and impudent than Steve Kerr. Popovich asked about China and what he has to say about China. He just congratulates Adam Silver for his meaningless pronouncement in defense of freedom of speech, and says nothing about China while going on the attack on Trump. Silver versus Trump is what Popovich wants to talk about.
Freedom of speech. It felt great again. He's been a heck of a leader in that respect, and very courageous. And when you compare it to what we've had to live through the last 3 years, the big difference, big gap there, leadership-wise and courage-wise. And it wasn't easy for him to say. He said that in an environment
Courageous.
Possible economic peril. But he sided with the principles that we all hold dearly, or most of us did, until the last 3 years. So I'm thrilled with what he said. And as I said, the courage and leadership displayed is off the charts by comparison. We've all talked about or heard about all the questions that all the talking heads have and everybody for the last 3 years. What kind of country do we want to be? Who are we? Where do we want to go? That sort of thing. Adam said something that helps you understand what direction you need to go in, rather than the cowardice of not being able to respond to something like the murder of Mr. Khashoggi. There are many, many incidents like that where it's leadership and courage mean nothing. It's
what about it?
Personal aggrandizement. So I was thrilled.
What kind of country do we want to be, right? Asked Greg Popovich. Sure. Apparently, we want to be a colony of the China, the Chinese, right, Greg? The courage to make a statement about free speech that is meaningless. Meaningless.
That's empty rhetoric. It's stupid.
Daryl Morey, pressure to retract. James Harden comes over the top. We love China. Steve Kerr won't comment on it. Steph Curry won't comment on it. LeBron James won't comment on it. Greg Popovich won't comment on it. And Adam Silver, we're supposed to compare to Tank Man. Are you kidding me? What are you going to do about the NBA? I mean, perhaps you gave up on the NBA long ago just because of the actual product, as so many have, thus the need to go to China. But, I mean, the NBA is the most important cultural institution in urban centers.
Well, 500 million Chinese residents watched at least one NBA game last season. That's huge. I mean, they're big. They make big bucks. And during the offseason, they go there and, you know, appear at malls and at events and make big bucks.
Speaking of courage, so there's Adam Silver. There's Adam Silver talking, and then there's the Trump administration doing, Greg, Coach Popovich. China responding, planning tighter visa restrictions for U.S. nationals with ties to anti-China groups. Yeah. What constitutes an anti-China group? The Falun Gong? Democracy protesters in Hong Kong? China planning tighter visa restrictions for U.S. nationals with ties to anti-China groups following the U.S. restrictions on Chinese nationals who are connected to the oppression of Muslim Uyghurs in China. So tell me again about courage. About what kind of country do we want to be, Greg? Tony on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, my little lammy lamb.
Hi.
Hey, you know what's really disturbing to me? There's over 500 players in the NBA, and not one has got these stones, the gonads, the giblets, the devil's figs to stand up against China and say, hey, I'm an American. This is what it is. That's all I have to say.
Thanks for the
call,
Coming
up with new terms all the time, huh?
I think you just wanted to get all of those synonyms for family jewels out. But it was good stuff. Mike in Union.
Hey, good morning. Hey, you know, when Dennis Rodman went to North Korea, everybody thought he was insane. And he probably was a little bit. But isn't the NBA players and the NBA Association doing the same thing, whoring themselves out to the Chinese? Just wanted to bring that up.
The almighty dollar.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, Rodman wasn't doing it for money. He was just doing it because he needs a friend.
Well, there's his little buddy.
Robert in Bloomingdale.
Yes, the time to deal with the Chinese was during the Tiananmen Square. The West wouldn't stand up to them. Now it's too late. They have too much invested. And now you got to look out for collusion between the Democrats and the Chinese to get rid of Trump. I am not kidding. It's for real.
Thanks for the call, Robert.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Picking up on Robert from Bloomingdale, we're talking about China and the NBA and the controversy over commenting on Hong Kong. But Robert from Bloomingdale made the point that China poses a bigger threat in 2020 in terms of meddling with the election than does Russia. He may be right about that. Good piece by Ross Clark at Spectator, spectator.us. The truth is China's tentacles go far deeper in Western societies than Russia's, largely thanks to its huge telecom industry. Many Westerners use Chinese phones, Chinese-built phone networks, presenting Chinese government-linked technology giants with immense opportunities for data gathering and control of content seen by phone users. An important point. In July of this year, a real estate tycoon and former rival to President Xi, now exiled in China, claimed the Chinese leader's already orchestrating a campaign to remove Trump from office using China's recently created National Security Commission. Guo Wengai is his name. He said for the 2020 U.S. presidential election, the Security Committee has given very clear instructions that it is not permissible for Trump to win the 2020 election. The Australian Strategic Policy Institute recently analyzed 97 elections held in countries since November of 2016, found that 20 of the 97, there was evidence of involvement by foreign powers. China was found to be active in only 4 compared with Russia's 16, but there was a big difference in terms of the kind of involvement. Russia was principally involved in a generalized campaign to undermine faith in democracy, like they did with, you know, Facebook ads and such here. China's operations in Australia, Indonesia, Singapore, and Taiwan were highly targeted at promoting China's interests. Except in Taiwan, they didn't seek so much as to influence which candidate emerged victorious as to change the terms of debate so that all the candidates adopted policies which would suit the Chinese. I'm going to talk about real Manchurian candidates here. As the Australian Strategic Policy Institute puts it, when China focused its propaganda efforts on foreign elections, quote, all consequential parties are in its crosshairs with a view to making them more sensitive to China's core interests. So in terms of election meddling, we've talked about, of course, foreign governments, most notably Russia. We've talked about big tech and their interest in deposing Trump. But the Chinese, given the hostilities across the range of trade to human rights, have all sorts of incentives to see a different president in the White House in 2020. And boy, I mean, with the courtship of Hunter's father going on in China, who could be better for them than Joe Biden?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Don't miss Sean Hannity, Michelle Malkin, and Laura Logan at Freedom Summit 2019. Get your tickets today at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Hey, how was your 7 hours of radio yesterday?
It was good.
Filled in for Prager?
Yeah, it was fun. It's always fun to fill in for His Eminence, Dennis Prager. It was a good time.
All right.
Covered this on Prager's show yesterday, but we didn't cover it, and it's not properly covered until we cover it. And that's Cheryl Atkison, friend of the show, good investigative journalist. Her show, Full Measure, we talk so much about examples of bad journalism or the lack of or phony journalism. How about an example of good journalism? Following the money, connecting inputs to outputs, reporting on outcomes that the American people might be interested in. Like, say, whatever happened to the $91 billion in hurricane aid that was provided to Puerto Rico after the two hurricanes that struck that island and obviously ended the lives of so many American citizens and disrupted the lives of hundreds of thousands more.
Because you knew that country was so in debt that that's why I didn't donate to any funds or any, you know, like I can donate to the Red Cross and Salvation Army, but that's it. But I didn't donate to any hurricane relief aids because I don't trust it. I don't trust them to do the right thing with our money. And they didn't do the right thing with the money. The money never got to the people. The help never arrived.
Well, here's the thing. You know, we're generous people and we see American citizens in need and we want to help them out. And so, of course, there was broad support for providing whatever the experts assessed was needed in financial support, material support to help people get back on their feet. But here's what actually happened. Cheryl Atkison going down to Puerto Rico, talked to some of the residents there, as well as the officials there that could fill in some of these blanks. $91 billion allocated. How much of it deployed and implemented and producing results for the people intended to be helped?
62,000 Puerto Rican hurricane victims like Rodriguez have been denied emergency help for technical reasons. That's despite a record amount of U.S. tax money being devoted to recovery. In all, it's estimated the recovery effort in Puerto Rico will amount to $91 billion U.S. tax dollars. Of that amount, we found the island has only received about $14 billion. The biggest single chunk, $5 billion, was spent fixing the electric system, which was already failing before the hurricane. Nearly $20 billion has been earmarked for housing and shelter under community planning and development. But 2 years after Maria, less than $1 million has been paid out.
$20 billion allocated. 2 years later, $1 million paid out. And what Atkinson did in her piece, she got up in a chopper to give you an aerial view, because one of the symbols of the failure of the response, the implementation phase, and I'm not assigning responsibility yet, but I will. One of the symbols of it, the blue tarps on people's right. houses. These FEMA blue tarps to cover people who lost their roof or the roof was damaged, so they have some shelter in place. They were supposed to be for 30 days. It's been 2 years. 2 years. She spoke with the Puerto Rican government's point person on the FEMA aid, Omar Marrero. Another example here, the money that was allocated to fix the schools for the kids.
You're talking about billions, and then you're like, well, they're well off. No, that money, even though it has been obligated, there's not still available for the people. This is the drama classroom.
Marrero told us not one damaged Puerto Rican school has seen permanent repairs in the past 2 years.
This is the music. Look at this.
Ooh, what is that?
That's, we call it comején. This is it's termites. I don't know how to say in English, comején.
Like their tunnel?
Yes.
Is this classroom being used?
Yes.
Yeah, so the termite-infested classroom is being used. Also porous roofs on some of these schools. Not one school remediated in 2 years.
How is that even possible? Who has the money? Where is the money?
Great question. This is the impetus for this investigative report. So it's a complicated answer, complicated by what Puerto Rico was prior to these natural disasters.
But it turns out the biggest disaster relief effort in American history is also the most complicated. Part of the explanation can be found in massive protests against Puerto Rico's government while we were there in July.
Fueling discontent in Puerto Rico is news that a number of government officials and contractors are under FBI investigation over allegations involving misuse of all the taxpayer money sent in after Hurricane Maria.
The FBI has arrested six top Puerto Rican government officials and consultants. Also charged, FEMA official Asha Tribble. Once an Obama Homeland Security advisor, Tribble took the lead on getting Puerto Rico's electric grid fixed. Now she's accused of taking bribes to steer a $1.8 billion contract to a company called Cobra. Cobra's CEO at the time and a FEMA friend of Tribble's who went to work for Cobra were also arrested. All have denied wrongdoing.
So corruption on the Puerto Rican government side, corruption at FEMA on the federal side. That certainly hasn't helped. And, you know, and what was deployed, what was the focus of those individuals? Letting and obligating the electric grid contract because they had cooked up a scheme, allegedly, apparently, to enrich themselves with that $5 billion worth of relief aid. And the other problem, in addition to corruption, is the financial mismanagement of Puerto Rico that preceded the natural disasters.
What's more, communities normally fund their own immediate repairs and apply to get paid back by FEMA. But Puerto Rico was bankrupt and mired in a corruption scandal before the hurricanes. That means they didn't have cash on hand.
FEMA, it is totally agnostic to the fiscal and economic situation of Puerto Rico. So, as opposed to Texas, we don't have a rainy day fund.
Because you're already under financial management because
exactly.
of your sort of like a bankruptcy.
Exactly, because when we came into public office, we were already dealing with two man-made hurricanes, fiscal and economic crisis. Those challenges on the fiscal side exacerbates even more the recovery process in Puerto Rico.
And FEMA official Jonathan Noyes echoed that.
Some of the assumptions we have about what a community can do for itself and how quickly they can do it don't necessarily apply. And that's where we all have to be as flexible and as patient, but as resourceful as we can be.
You know, we have a tendency, and this is across the spectrum. Somebody put money to something. Somebody passed a law. So there you go. That's done.
We're gone. Move on.
And then there's the actual implementation, particularly when it's state directed. And this is a case study in the problems and also sort of the lack of consideration for the limitations of the state. Many of those, as Omar Marrero, that Puerto Rican official you heard from, man-made corruption and the profligacy, how Puerto Rico ran itself into bankruptcy by living beyond its means, the same way that, boy, talk Illinois about cautionary
did.
Tales,
yeah.
Illinois, no rainy day fund.
And now they get El Gallito, one of our lawmakers, is moving to Puerto Rico.
And what did we hear during the post-hurricane response? It was all about Trump's a racist this and Trump's sitting on aid that and he's not serious and people are struggling. Well,
he
what
threw
about
paper towel roll at the Puerto Ricans?
What about the Puerto Rican officials? Not just at that time, but the Puerto Rican officials that had made all those decisions that left their power grid exposed in a dilapidated condition, left their country, left their territory bankrupt, left their citizens in poverty while they were enriching themselves. The combination of formal corruption, bribery, and the corruption of the public policy process, which isn't illegal, but is perhaps more damaging, just as it's been in Chicago and Illinois. You know, I'm watching this report by Cheryl Atkinson. I'm thinking about one of my favorite stories about Illinois in terms of crystallizing the indictment of the political ruling class. Jimmy John Leotude, when he pulled Jimmy John's corporate headquarters out of Illinois and took it to Florida. I don't mind paying taxes. I've been successful in life. I've been lucky, happy to pay my fair share. I want to see people helped. And, you know, I'm happy to have the government do some of the lifting on that. So pay my fair share, whatever. Here's what I won't do. I won't be scammed. I'm tired of my money sent to Springfield, not going for what the politicians say it's going to go for. It isn't going for the services for vulnerable populations that they say they're providing. That's not happening. It isn't going to rebuild, improve our infrastructure to make Illinois a more attractive place economically. That's not happening. They're lying to me. And the invoices get bigger, and so do Illinois' problems. So I don't need to know the details to know that something is amiss here. So that same kleptocracy that made Puerto Rico so vulnerable and greatly exacerbated the extent and the duration of the damage done by those hurricanes. Fortunately, Illinois is not in hurricane territory because we're in the exact same position. And it's great reporting by Atkinson. Connect dots. Follow the money. Don't just go on reputation. Don't believe because somebody had a press conference and said this is taken care of, that it's taken care of. And this is what the Fourth Estate should be doing. Following up on the pronouncements of politicians to see what outcomes were derived from what inputs. So hat tip to our friend Cheryl Atkinson.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're just poring over Cheryl Atkinson's investigative piece on the $91 billion in U.S. taxpayer aid to Puerto Rico after the hurricanes. And
how much did they get?
Well, $14 billion has been deployed so far, a third of that to the power grid there, and the people that we want to see helped, who need to be helped, are not being helped 2 years later. Sad commentary, and it's both a local and federal failure. Bill and McHenry, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan. Nice job on Dennis's show yesterday, by the way. And
thank you.
We're looking forward to seeing both you and Amy at the Freedom Summit.
Oh, great.
Do we suppose foolishly that perhaps Cheryl Atkinson's going to get a Pulitzer Prize for this investigative reporting? It was kind of a breath of fresh air to see a journalist really doing
journalism.
His or her job.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, yes, fantastic stuff.
Yeah, it's really good.
Thanks for highlighting it, really.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate that. Yeah, I don't suspect that Cheryl Atkinson, she's you know, been ostracized from the Beltway press corps, so I didn't suspect she's going to get too many awards, but she's, but pieces like that are certainly deserving of them. Regardless, she's educating people, and she's making people do what we're just so bad at doing, connecting inputs to outputs. I'll say it to my dying breath, connecting inputs to outputs. It's the only way you can understand what's happening.
And be careful who you're giving your money to. There's a woman who was arrested yesterday, charged with fraud, mail fraud, and identity theft having to do with victims of the hurricane in Houston. She stole $4,900 for a French bulldog and $15,000 for plastic surgery out of people's money that they donated to her cause. So just be careful who you're giving money to.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Vice President Mike Pence was in Iowa doing his vice president's duties in support of the president's policy agenda and calling on the House to take up something other than impeachment.
I came to Iowa today to say it's time for the Democrats in Congress to do their job, put politics aside, and pass the USMCA this year. The truth is, and we all know it, Democrats have been spending all their time on endless investigations and a partisan impeachment. But enough is enough. The American people deserve better.
Well, they're not going to get better. That's at least according to Dan Henninger in the Wall Street Journal, and I agree with him. Here's how he suggests the next 13 months will go in terms of the competing arguments. Mr. Trump has begun to make his argument at his rallies. You may not like me, he says, but you're going to have to vote for me to save your 401k against Ms. Warren, whose plans are virtually alien to the idea of economic growth. This is a plausible strategy. It's me or the deep blue sea. For Democrats, impeaching Trump is just one big bomb and a larger strategy for the long march back to power next year. Their plan is to make the country's political life so intolerable that the American people simply run up the white flag on the Trump presidency no mas. They're looking at the 10 to 15% that are less committed either way in the expectation these voters will decide that making accommodations between policy and personality has become impossible and that four more years of this would be too much to endure, even accepting 401k losses as the price of deliverance. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined again by Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Great to be with you.
So what do you say to Henninger's formulation in terms of what Trump is attempting to do? You may not like me, but look at how you're doing financially. And the Democrats, you might be doing well financially, but we're just going to beat this drum until you submit and say we got to make a change.
Well, I think the president's position is correct. 100 million people with 401ks, IRAs, lifetime savings, every plan that Elizabeth Warren or Biden, well, he's not any different than Warren. She's just been more explicit about all the taxes she plans to raise. And Bernie Sanders and all the other Democrats, they all plan a war on your 401k, on lifetime savings. When they talk about a wealth tax, that just means everything you've saved during your life. That's wealth, okay? That is your wealth. And they want to tax your income, your wealth, your savings, your 401k. They've been putting some radical ideas about basically confiscating your 401k, like it was an AR-15 gun that they want to confiscate, and folding it into something else, like Social Security, and taking your money to pay off Social Security's debts. They did this in Argentina. Didn't work out very well, but the left is in power, so it worked out well for that. If that's your goal. This is going to be a debate about the direction of the country. Do you want a Supreme Court that actually reads the Constitution or one that makes it up as you go along? Trump and the Republicans have been restoring rule of law. in the Supreme Court. The lower taxes have given us the growth we're looking at. And, you know, the census data, which was just recently looked at, in the 2.5 years of the Trump presidency, we have seen the median household income, the absolute middle household income, half more, half less, go up by 4,000 votes up to $65,000. That's an increase of $4,000 each year in 2.5 years. During the 16 years of Trump and Obama, it went up by $1,000. So in 2.5 years, Trump and the Republicans have moved the middle income, not the richest, not the poorest, the middle income American household up $4,000, four times as much, even more than $4,000, four times as much as the previous 16 years. That's why middle income people were so grumpy in the election in 2016. There's a good reason to be grumpy. If you go 16 years without seeing middle incomes increase more than $1,000. So that's where we are now. The challenge is, of course, that the more the Democrats threaten the economy with higher taxes, the weaker the growth is. And then they can say, see, growth is slowed down. But as the president does better in the polls, you'll see the economy do better. I do think it's important we come to an agreement with China that would be helpful to farmers and everyone else, certainly the Canadian, Mexican-American free trade zone, the improvement on NAFTA. Very helpful to American farmers and all exporters.
Well, today's the 13th round of trade talks with China, and Trump says that China does want to make a deal, and he's pushed back raising tariffs yet again. Do you see something happening this time around?
I think it's very possible. This has gone on for a long time. Pain has been inflicted on both sides. The president's quite right that we cannot continue to have China stealing our intellectual property, you know, the way they have been. They have not dealt fairly with us. I don't suppose we solve all of our problems with China in one agreement, but I would take every step forward that allows us. The stronger we get economically, the more clout we have in negotiating with China.
When it comes to the spend side, the Trump record is decidedly unfiscally conservative. Would it be helpful for the president to acknowledge some of the things he hasn't been able to do, some of the things he hasn't focused on, some of the things he hasn't pressed the Democrats on, just in terms of, you know, burnishing his credential as somebody who is authentic, somebody who is not a politician, the fact that you own things that you didn't accomplish, you own the sort of spending that's not consistent with shrinking the size of government and making additional room for private sector investment?
Well, it's simply true that when he lost control of the House, he lost control of the ability to manage the budget, just as when Obama lost control of the House. He couldn't get the tax increases he wanted, couldn't get the spending increases he wanted, because all you have to do is hold the House, the Senate, or the presidency, and you have a lot of power, the House and the Senate being more powerful than the president on all budget matters. Had we not lost that Senate seat in Alabama, they were going to do entitlement reform, and you would have seen significant long-term savings. We need a Republican Senate, a Republican House, and a president, and we can get those savings. That was a real missed opportunity. The people of Alabama have got a lot to answer for.
You think there's real interest, there's real appetite for taking on entitlements if you were to see a Trump reelected and somehow the Republicans take back the House?
Oh, absolutely. They're going to do it in year two. That was the plan. That was the goal, get the tax cut, repeal. Well, we got undercut by McCain, who promised to vote to repeal Obamacare, which would have been a $1 trillion tax cut, by the way, in a decade, a $1 trillion tax cut. And, of course, it's a massive producer of deficits and debt in the out years. It spends much, much more money than it ever raises in taxes, even though it does a lot of both. That was devastating to us, and that's John McCain's legacy to America, just because he wanted to be mean to Trump. Very sad, but very expensive decision by Senator McCain. And then we lost that Senate seat in Alabama. I was in the White House talking to people. They were all set to go. But when we didn't have that extra vote, You just couldn't get it across the finish line. But you're quite right. The president needs to point out that what he has said, we're not going to touch Medicare and Social Security, those you pay into, but all of the welfare programs that people don't pay anything into, but get, those have to be block grants now to the states, just as Clinton did with aid to families with dependent children. We've seen it work. 50 states are less stupid than one federal government in how they deal with handling their own state's issues.
Are you advising and counseling the president to maintain some message discipline about framing 2020 as sort of a capitalism versus socialism, markets versus central planning choice for the voters?
Yeah, I think the president's made it clear he's going to be talking a lot about your life savings, your 401k, your IRA. There's 100 million people with a 401k IRA. That is the vast majority of Americans. And when Elizabeth Warren says she's going to go after the 1%, she's missing two digits. She's going after 100% of Americans with those tax increases, because if you don't have savings, you don't have new businesses. And the people who do the savings, 100 million Americans who are doing that, if you strip their savings, one, you damage them, but you also damage the ability of everybody else to work. We know the story. There are more jobs in the United States looking for people than there are people in the workforce. That is incredible progress.
He is Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Check out his latest piece at foxbusiness.com. Middle-class Americans fearing better than ever during Trump presidency, which he was just describing when he talked about the median household income. Grover, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, do you have trouble making friends?
Well, I don't, but you might.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636 DA, turnkey.pro answer line. Or text line, 64636 DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Want to be friends with Dan Prof line if you know, people can call in?
How do you make friends, or do you make friends?
Or do you just keep the good ones that you have had for the last few decades?
A survey finds the average American hasn't made a new friend in 5 years. Survey of 2,000 Americans commissioned by Evite dug into the reasons why Americans struggle with new friendships. About 40% say they have trouble making friends because of introversion or shyness.
Dan.
A third of adults blame the lack of new friendships on their aversion to the bar scene.
Dan. Oh, no, that's not you.
A third of respondents also feel everyone else's circle of friends have already formed, making it harder to join.
That's me.
Other reasons for antisocial attitude include commitments to family.
That's me.
Not having hobbies conducive to making friends. Well, that would be me. So not as many people are interested in taxidermy as you might think.
Right, exactly. Well, you play golf, but when you play golf, you don't sit in the cart. You just walk.
I don't use a cart.
So you're not making friends.
I'm making friends with a caddy. And moving to a new city was another reason for the difficulty in making new friends. 45% of those surveyed say they would go out of their way to make new friends if they knew how or had more opportunities to do so. Tell us how you make friends if you make friends. So you're a social butterfly. You're a celebrated figure in Lakeview in the greater Chicagoland area.
Yeah, I'm not friends with people. I'm friends with their children. Because I coach their kids. Oh. I know that sounds weird. I'm just saying I coach their kids.
Yeah.
So I spend more time with them. But I keep it a coach-player relationship. I don't want to know about any drama. I don't need to feed into their dramas. I keep it simple.
I'm apparently among a small minority that's not that didn't register in terms of the top reasons, top five or six reasons of misanthropy. What about just you have a general misanthropic attitude? You're very much an acolyte of Jean-Paul Sartre, who observed that hell is other people.
Hell is, wow.
What if?
How are you going to ever make friends if you have a T-shirt that says hell is other people?
I don't have a T-shirt.
Hi, I'm Dan Proft.
I don't have a T-shirt and I don't introduce myself. So that's another reason why I don't.
But now that you have a dog, don't you find yourself talking to other dog owners?
No. I talk to my dog.
But I'm saying, well, don't you, when you walk your dog, don't you run into other dog owners and strike up a conversation?
Exactly. And Hayek shoos them away just like that. Actual audio.
No, honestly, you don't talk to people while you're walking Hayek?
They you know what?
I don't know how many ways I could ask you.
They say, like, is your dog friendly? And I say, my dog is friendly. I'm not. So keep it moving.
I can see you doing that.
I'll keep it short and sweet. Family, religion, friendship. These are the three demons you must slay if you wish to succeed in business.
Sound advice from Mr. Burns. What about you? How do your boys make friends? Or,
well, boys are different than girls. Like, girls plan things. You know, they'll have sleepovers or they'll meet or go shopping. Guys, they don't really plan things, so it's all spur of the moment. But they'll have, you know, they're starting to go out to breakfast with their friends, which is cool. On the weekends, they'll go out to breakfast. And
dim sum.
Yeah, you know.
Brunch at the Four Seasons. Sure.
No, they must go to the diner or Badaki's on Damon. They'll go meet up there. But, yeah, and then sports. If they didn't have sports, they would not have the friendships that they have formed.
I assume, I mean, obviously.
Because they're with them every day after school.
If you have family and then, you know, you don't run into a lot of new people in your work situation very much, I would think it'd be difficult.
No, I don't run into anybody.
Yeah.
I've been stuck with this zoo crew for 9 years.
Not me.
Not you.
I'm
well,
new.
Five.
I'm the new kid.
Oh, yeah, right. 4 years. How long have we been working together?
5 years. This is the fifth year.
Oh, my gosh.
Year.
Are you getting me a card?
This is your one new friend in 5 years.
Yeah.
So you're beating the average. Yeah. Congratulations.
Since 2016, though, I lost friends.
Oh, so
Trump.
you're net down.
So now I'm down, yeah. But now that I'm
they
at a new high
friends.
School. I know. They were just friendly to me. But now that I'm at a new high school, I'm trying to meet, you know, more parents on the sidelines. We had a JV football game last night, so I go up and insert myself. Hi, I'm Amy. Which son is your? What number is your son? You know.
Yeah.
I try to make friends that way.
I'm trying to. I joined a poetry reading group.
Did you?
And
that's great.
I'm in a Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Of course you are.
Organization. Uh-huh. They're recently in town. They did a movie at the Cadillac Theater with Joel Hodgson, the creator of Mystery Science Theater, this past Saturday.
Oh, did you go? So it sounds like you went. Did you meet any friends while you were there?
No.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So, of course, President Trump is facing criticism from all angles on his decision to remove U.S. military presence in Syria, including from his erstwhile neocon allies like Senator Lindsey Graham. But I point you to this interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal by the always thought-provoking Walter Russell Mead, who was a foreign affairs professor at Yale and now is at Bard College, where he also teaches humanities. He writes, much of the criticism of Trump is justified, erratic nature of Trump-era policymaking, often unpredictable policy mix that results. However, there are two other stories from the Middle East in the last week that make the American position in the region an odd mix of dominance and impotence that makes good policymaking difficult, and it well predates Trump. The first development is a success story that undermines how dominant the U.S. can become. Fearing U.S. sanctions, China National Petroleum Corp. has abandoned plans for a multi-billion dollar investment in an Iranian gas field, part of a broader Chinese retreat from Iran in the face of American pressure. Well, that's good. That's good. And it's an accomplishment for the Trump administration. The second development, the violent protests shaking Iraq, which tell us something equally important. The U.S. may be the paramount power in the region, but nobody has a solution to the developmental and political crisis that continues to destabilize too many countries across the Middle East. Iraq isn't the only country in the region trapped in a cycle of dysfunctional governance and blocked development. The forces that produced the Arab Spring remain at work in the region, but the progress is uneven at best. He goes on, Walter Russell Mead, Trump isn't the first president to try to hold America back from a Middle East conflict. While Mr. Trump's Syria decision may also prove to be a mistake, as was Obama's drawing of the red line and subsequently not defending it, it should give the establishment pause that two presidents as different as Obama and Trump reach similar conclusions about the political risks in the Middle East. The U.S. may be the most powerful actor in the region, but it can't resolve the economic and social conflicts that destabilize the Middle East. As long as that is the case, those who want presidents to commit to long-term military engagements, however limited and however advantageous, must expect a skeptical hearing in the Oval Office.
Well, that's not, but President Trump yesterday offered a bizarre defense for his abrupt decision to pull U.S. forces out of northern Syria.
Now, the Kurds are fighting for their land, just so you understand. They're fighting for their land. And as somebody wrote in a very, very powerful article today, they didn't help us in the Second World War. They didn't help us with Normandy, as an example. They mentioned names of different battles. They were there, but they're there to help us with their land. And that's a different thing. In addition to that, we have spent tremendous amounts of money on helping the Kurds in terms of ammunition, in terms of weapons, in terms of money, in terms of pay. With all of that being said, we like the Kurds.
For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Stephen Bucci, retired Army Special Forces officer, top Pentagon official. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies. Stephen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
What's your reaction to the decision and then to, you know, some uneven opinion outside of political circles and academic circles, I point to Walter Russell Mead, about the judiciousness of open-ended presence, military presence in places like Syria?
Well, I think that starting with that part, look, we don't have a long-term set of interests in Syria. Our involvement in Syria was solely based on trying to put down ISIS. You know, some people have tried to say, oh, but we should be in there helping get rid of Assad and all that. You know, we've never, none of the presidents who've been involved in this had that as a goal. True, the Kurds helped us. But remember, all these, when you say the Kurds helped us, all the Kurds are not uniform. They're not one large group. You know, you hear people say, oh, but they protected the Yazidis. Okay, those were the Kurds in Iraq. They're not the Kurds in Syria. They're different groups. And this group in Syria is more attached to some of the Kurds that are in the actual sovereign territory of Turkey. And they have been declared a terrorist group by not just the Turks, but by the United States, by the UN, by NATO, and the guys in Syria are their affiliate. So, yes, they did help us, but they're not innocent bystanders. They're not, you know, just the nicest guys in the world. They're really good fighters, but they're not, you know, babes sitting there waiting to be slaughtered. So this is, bottom line is, this is a very complicated, very complex issue that a lot of the pundits and a lot of the politicians are trying to boil down to a couple of sound bites, and that's just not serving the nation or our people well in trying to explain this.
Well, what about the detention centers that have some 11,000 members of ISIS in it? Because the Kurds are leaving their posts, and President Trump thinks that those 11,000 people are just going to go back to Europe.
Well, that's, you know, we have told the Turks, look, if you're coming in there and, you know, you want control of this area, you're building this so-called buffer zone so you can move the 3 million Syrian refugees out of your country back into their country. Part of that isn't just building camps for the refugees. It's going to be taking charge of these ISIS personnel and these detainees and managing them and not letting them get loose, head back to Europe. And, you know, hopefully the United States and the rest of the international community will hold Turkey's feet to the fire on that responsibility. You know, you want to be in charge, you got to be in charge. And that was the message that was sent to them by multiple sources as they go forward with this operation.
Are we being naive to believe that Syria, Jordan, Turkey, Iran, Iraq, the Gulf states can deal with what remains of ISIS?
No, you know, I don't think we are. I think those countries can deal with what remains. They were not able to deal with it at their height, obviously. We had to go in there with other folks and help them. But, you know, ISIS is pretty well beat down now. They're not gone, clearly. But, you know, hopefully this handoff back to the regional powers is the right time to do it. I tend to agree with Professor Mead that this is not something we ever signed up to be in forever. And, you know, folks, you know, we didn't have enough soldiers there to protect the Kurds anyway. If the Turks really decided to come in, it's not like we had multiple, you know, army divisions or marine divisions there fighting. We only had advisors and logistical personnel anyway.
Well,
of my old, you know, special operators.
We're providing artillery support and the like, yeah.
Yeah.
But are we talking about 1,000 U.S. troops were there?
That's, you know, they have not for a long time listed the actual number, but that seems to be the consensus on most of the experts. It's around 1,000, which means it could be 1,200 or it could be 800. So it's not a significant cohesive fighting force. They're mostly support personnel with some special operators to do particular missions, but not enough to hold off a major conventional force, which, by the way, is a NATO ally. So we don't really want to fight Turkey. That's kind of awkward for us and for them. So we're kind of protecting our guys, making sure they don't get caught in the middle, because, to be honest with you, we don't like American forces being tripwires. Mm-hmm. And we really don't want to have a pitched battle with a NATO ally.
Your colleague at Heritage, Jim Carafano, in an interview sort of framed it this way. So basically, here's our three concerns in the region as it pertains to this decision. We don't want another caliphate. We want the problems of Syria to stay in Syria. In other words, we don't want another situation of a destabilizing refugee crisis that impacts allies like Jordan. And thirdly, we don't want Iran to be able to establish a platform in Syria that they can use to threaten Israel. And so he essentially says those are our three goals. And so then we have to ask the question, does the continued troop presence there serve to achieve any of those three goals? If it doesn't, then we shouldn't be there. If it does, then we should.
Well, I would add a nuance to Jim's characterization there. I think that the presence there does lend itself to contributing to those goals, but is it sufficient to warrant staying there really long term? Turkey coming in there, if Turkey can actually set up this buffer zone that they are claiming they're going to set up, and if they can take charge of the ISIS detainees in a meaningful way, I think it will actually contribute to those goals and serve the purpose of freeing up our guys and gals to go somewhere else or to just come home, which, you know, President Trump did campaign on that. He didn't want to leave people everywhere. So I think there's some room to say if we leave and the Turks come in, we will still be contributing to those goals. But it left to itself, if the Turks didn't want to do this, I think it would be smart to leave our guys there. Since the Turks are going to try and do this, it's probably more sensible to move them out.
And Doug Bondo, writing in the National Interest, admittedly he is a libertarian non-interventionist, but he does point to an extraordinary record of failure in the region, whether it be you know, state building exercises or something less audacious. And so if you agree with that, and we understand the history of not being able to do the things that we hoped we'd be able to do, so easily exporting small-d democracy to places like North Africa and the Middle East, then why so vociferous a response from both Democrats and Republicans to Trump's decision to withdraw, you know, what, as you say, between 800 and 1,200 troops from this region? It seems that the response is disproportionate to the action.
Well, there's a couple of factors at play here. One is on the Democrat side, you know, anything President Trump does, they're going to try and throw gasoline on and set it on fire because they think that's politically advantageous. On the other hand, because so many folks conflate the different Kurdish groups and think, well, if the Turks are going to come in and slap around this, you know, one of the smaller Kurdish populations in Syria, that means they're dumping on all of them. And, you know, we've abandoned these folks that fought with us in Iraq, and they're not all the same. So some of it is based on an incomplete understanding of who the heck is playing in this scene. And there's a lot of investment on the part of neocon types that we, you know, we should be there and we should be doing something, but most of them actually want us not just to leave the 1,200, they want us to move on and you know, dethrone Assad, which frankly we're not going to do. That's never been in the cards. It's never been our goal, and they would like to see us do more. You know, that's not happening. And so if you're neither fish or fowl, you know, sometimes it's best to get out. So, you know, I'm not a libertarian. I do believe in the use of military power to protect our interests abroad. But in this case, you know, we're not talking about if this was happening in Jordan. Yeah, that's in our interest to go in there, send in troops and help an allied government. You know, going in and fighting a NATO ally and a government that's supported by Iran and Russia in that region, this is a losing fight in the long term. So there's people have different reasons. Sorry for the long answer to your short question, but it's complicated.
No.
And folks have different reasons for going crazy over this decision, and some of them are valid, some of them are not.
No, that's exactly, no, I appreciate it. We want light here, not heat. Heat is easy. That's what the politicians do. So we appreciate the light that you've provided, Stephen Bucci, who is a retired Army Special Forces officer and top Pentagon official. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Always a pleasure. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we get into the sum and substance of the impeachment gambit with investigative journalist Lee Smith, I just have to say something about this Fox poll that the cable news networks, the Beltway media, is positively orgasmic over this morning.
Drooling over it because it came from Fox.
Scott Rasmussen had a good post on this, and it wasn't critical. It was just a methodological point that they way undersampled independents in that poll, meaning they way oversampled Democrats, and that's what's driving you to majority. Independents and other polling have been evenly split. Of course, Republicans are wildly against it, and Democrats are wildly for it. So before we start to buy their narrative that there's some sort of groundswell happening and it's cresting over Trump's head, it's just not the case, and it would never be the case with respect to one survey anyway. And then the last point, of course, is this shouldn't be public opinion driven. This should be based on the merits of whether or not what's being alleged, even if true, rose to the level of a high crime or misdemeanor. And now what if it isn't true? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Lee Smith, who is a columnist at Tablet Magazine, author of The Strong Horse, Power, Politics, and the Clash of Arab Civilizations, and the Consequences of Syria as well. Always does great news analysis. Often read at realclearinvestigations.com. Lee, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. I just want to say also I have a new book coming out called, it deals with the discussion that we're going to have this morning called The Plot Against the President, The True Story of How Congressman Devin Nunes Uncovered the Biggest Political Scandal of All Time. So, what began as Russiagate has rolled into now, how do we want to describe it, Ukrainegate.
Well, that's the point you make. I wanted to start there. That's the point you make in your piece. It's not all about the Bidens. That Ukraine is an extension of the last 2.5 years of Trump Russia.
Right. They've been trying to unelect Trump since hours after the 2016 election. So yeah, this is just a continuation of that effort. I think that one of the ways it might be a little different is that they learned to speed things up, that they'd invested so much in Mueller and they thought that was a good thing to wait for nearly 2 years. And of course, that did affect the 2018 election. I think that one of the things they're doing differently now is moving as quickly as possible to generate as much speed and momentum as possible and to, roll this into another effort to undo the results of the 2016 election.
Well, but do you think soon that they'll take, a House vote on the floor for an impeachment inquiry?
I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of people who know the procedural maneuvers a lot better than I do, and they argue that Pelosi's in pretty good position here. I mean, this, of course, one reason why the White House says that they're not going to cooperate with the inquiry until they take a vote.
Yeah.
I think the important things to look at is when you spoke before about whether or not it's true, I think it's important to look at this and to see how this resembles the Russiagate thing, because what we learned, we all knew it was hokum from the beginning, but the Mueller report, after nearly 2 years of more than $30 million of driving a wedge between the in the public sphere between the right and the left in this country, Mueller found no evidence of collusion. Right. There was nothing to it. The same thing is happening here. What's important to look at and what I try to do in my piece is to say, if you look at what's going on here and you realize it's a replay of the Russia operation or it's the same exact operation just continued, that answers the question whether or not the story about Ukraine is true.
Well,
seriously, should we take it? Is it truly reasonable grounds for impeachment or not? I say resoundingly, no, more nonsense.
Well, and importantly, too, it's another instance seemingly of projection. The Democrats projecting onto Trump what they actually were engaged in, whether it's Steele dossier and his alleged Russian sources for that dossier. And then in Ukraine, as John Solomon has reported in The Hill, you had a Ukrainian-American operative approach the Ukrainian embassy for information on the Trump campaign. This was reported in Politico, hardly a conservative outlet.
Yes.
And a dossier on Manafort, again, for political reasons, regardless of what Manafort's business dealings were. So, again, it seems like the people that were engaged in enlisting foreign help to meddle in the 2016 election were the Democrats.
Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And the way that they turned it around, the way that they've managed to hang this picture frame around Donald Trump's neck is a factor of the fact that the press is no longer liberal. The press is a component of a political operation, of democratic political operations. I mean, it's very disturbing, but I think that this is something that we need to come to a realization of in order to move ahead or to understand what politics looks like right now in the country, what the public sphere looks like. We've all known, and it's been going this way for a long time, that the media leans to the left. That's not what's happening anymore. with the entire dossier stuff, we moved into very different territory where they're part of the press is part of an operation. And that's what's going on right now with the Ukraine stuff, right? All you need to do is pull back and ask a few reasonable questions. Who's this whistleblower guy? Shouldn't someone think whether, look at how astonishing this is. The simple fact is, let's just pull it away, whether or not the whistleblower is right or wrong, whether the whistleblower is a wonderful person, a noble American public servant, or whether there's something wrong with what this person is saying. The basic fact is this. It's a CIA, an active CIA officer. Right. And there is no one in the press who has even brought up the simple point. There is no Democrat who has stood up and said, hey, look, I have a problem with Trump. I've had a problem with Trump longer than any of you here. But I'll tell you what, I didn't like this Russia operations. It was nonsense. It was damaging the public sphere. I'll tell you what else I don't like. I don't like this. This whistleblower might be right on the ball. I don't know. But the look at it, the fact that a CIA official is in an active CIA officer is in the middle of this. This looks really bad to me. This looks bad.
Well, what about...
Why is a CIA guy in the middle of it?
Right, but also, too, the great lengths that they're going to go to hear his testimony, take him to an undisclosed location, only let certain lawmakers put a screen in front of him and, you know, distort his voice. That just seems... And on the information that he has is hearsay as well. He's not the whistleblower with the alleged firsthand knowledge.
Absolutely.
But if he's going to accuse the president of this, I mean, my God, an impeachment, we need to see... the accuser. I agree with President Trump on that. Do you?
You absolutely. You would think that someone would say, that people in the press would say, as I just said, hold on, wait a minute here. We've got an active CIA officer. Now we need to slow down before we move on this, because this could have disastrous effects for the country. We're talking about an intelligence officer. Now maybe this is all on the level, but if it's not, what are we doing here? What kind of thing are we ushering in to the government? But apparently none of that matters.
He is Lee Smith, columnist at Tablet Magazine, author of the forthcoming book. Give us the book title again, Lee.
It's The Plot Against the President, the true story of how Congressman Devin Nunes uncovered the biggest political scandal of all time.
Some vindication for Devin Nunes. That's long overdue. Lee Smith, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me on this morning.
Take care.
Thanks.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, you really have to hear this. Oak Park Village trustee, Dr. Susan Buchanan. This during a recent discussion at a Oak Park Village board meeting. No, not of the nuclear free zone. That Oak Park still enjoys that designation. You are not allowed to possess or deploy nuclear weapons in Oak Park. Okay.
Why would they even waste their time passing that law?
They did virtue signaling before it was all the rage.
Yeah.
They did in Oak Park.
I remember for a while they were doing they didn't want people to be distracted while driving, so they wanted to ban people from eating fast food in their cars.
They're taking up much more heady matters now. Dr. Susan Buchanan and her colleagues debating the contents of the village's diversity statement.
Isn't diversity a wooden ship?
That's right.
Ron Burgundy told me that.
And this is how that debate went.
Yeah, I
don't want to hear what you have to say.
Oh, my gosh.
No, come I'm on. Serious.
Susan,
Jim, why do you have an opinion on this?
Come on, Susan. Susan, this is... I won't say a word.
That's why I like to...
You shouldn't have an opinion on that.
I met with constituents of color, and quite honestly, some of the feedback was that some of this wording was ridiculous.
From birth, you have been white from birth. Why are you arguing what is a system of oppression? You've never experienced one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So shut up! I don't want to hear from you. Just stop. Just stop, Dan. Stop, Dino. You are not oppressed. And people in Oak Park are. And we are trying to recognize that as a community.
Mm-hmm.
This mayor and this board is obviously not willing to face history. We have a chance to make history. It is time for this community.
Mm-hmm.
to face equity. Enough! And you stop it! You are a white male! Stop it! You are a white male! Yeah, your skin is light enough! Stop it!
I gotta let
go. I think if we reduce these conversations to nobody cares what you have to say because you're a white male, I don't think we're doing this right.
And then the sergeant at arms took Trustee Dan Maroney out to the diversity gulag in Oak Park. Dr. Susan Buchanan, she was in family practice, so I don't know if she's still taking on new patients in case you wanted to reach out to her to be your family doctor. She is apparently certified in both family and preventative medicine, and she's clinical associate professor of occupational and environmental health sciences at UIC.
Ooh.
Well, very credentialed. She must be smart.
Well, she is white, but the reason why she, you know, is yelling at people to shut up and stop it because they're white is because she's married to an African-American and has a child with him. So that's why I think that she feels so entitled that she can have opinion on this, but he can't. Because he's white.
Translation,
if you're white, you don't care or have empathy.
An opinion.
Can't be wrong.
Opinion. She is the self-designated spokesman for oppressed black and brown people. And she will also define for you, black and brown people, what exactly the nature of your oppression is so that you don't have to do any of the figuring. But that's not patronizing at all.
Oh, no. I just got a text message. Morning. Hilarious. He's being oppressed by her right now.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Susan Buchanan, now there was some time for audience comment, at which point a gentleman named Bill Burr took to the mic.
What happened to you today, sweetheart? Huh? Did they not chill your rosé? You know? Was the trolley not running down at the mall? What happened? No, it's unreal. I'm really fucking annoyed how white women have the fucking balls to throw my white privilege in my face, you know? Start to separate themselves from these white males with their white male privilege. It's like, bitch, you're sitting in a jacuzzi with me. The f*** are you talking about?
So good.
When will self-respecting, even if you're left of center, black and brown people, which is how she referred to you, by the way, when will you say, you know what, Dr. Buchanan, I'm good.
Yeah.
I'll represent myself. I'll speak in my own voice. I understand this is the source of your self-esteem. This is a source of your meaning in life, like so many of your champagne socialist, aging white colleagues, white female colleagues in the suburbs. I understand it. I hate to strip that of you and have to search for something actually substantive around which to organize your life. But I'll speak for myself. I got this. I'm self-actualized. I have agency. I don't need you to be pretending to speak for me, number one, and to do it in the form of a meaningless diversity statement from some municipality that is not going to help one black or brown person, that is not going to provide one iota of benefit for any sort of dialogue on racial harmony or opportunity or anything of particular importance when it comes to people's quality of life. This is nothing. This is hysteria around nothing, doing nothing for anybody, white, black, brown, or other. It's just remarkable to watch this on display, isn't it? Or are we so inured to it? I mean, I told you, like, oh, you think this happens that, like, as some circus on a cable news show or a college campus or the streets of Portland. But I mean, it's not like I'm ever going to have to deal with it. So it's just popcorn chewing entertainment for me. Right. Well, it's coming to your school. It's coming to your local government. It's coming to your corporate boardroom. It's coming to your downtown, it's coming to places where you socialize, unless you stand up, as some of the trustees, you know, the barely managed to do.
Well, you can't deal with crazy, and clearly, I mean, she was She's not of her mind. I mean, her platform.
You actually can deal with it.
Oh, you can? Well, the voters can. They can vote her out.
Well, that's one way to deal with it, too, yes. But if I for these guys to...
What would you have said to her?
For these guys, just what I said.
Okay.
For these guys to sit there and get harangued, you're not going to shut me down. Who the hell do you think you are, doctor?
Then she'd come back and say, well, I married an African-American.
Congratulations.
Good.
That is completely irrelevant to the topic of conversation. By the way, the topic of conversation is completely irrelevant on its face. We're talking about a diversity statement.
But she's so leaning lefty that she thinks a diversity statement will make people of color, as she puts on her webpage, feel that the village is more welcoming for them.
There's an excellent piece in the summer edition of National Affairs by Josh Mitchell, who's an academic, Why Conservatives Struggle with Identity Politics. And he talks about the two definitions of identity, the two usages. One is innocuous. It's to identify kind. My identity is American. My identity is Protestant. My identity is Jewish. My identity is Roman Catholic. Innocuous. The other is quite different. And it's at the heart of what the identity politics, like you saw on display here, people actually self-lobotomizing. It's a relationship. It's a kind of relationship, morally freighted relationship of a particular sort. Understood this way, writes Professor Mitchell, identity is a concept with discernible religious overtones. It refers to an unpayable debt one kind owes another as a result of an unforgivable wrong. It describes a relationship of transgressor and victim. Josh Mitchell, Georgetown University. And he uses the example of the French in Algiers, right? Battle of Algiers, great movie, by the way. French identity is one kind, Algerian identity is another, and nothing more need to be said. But when identity takes on the second meaning, something different is involved. French and Algerian now stand in relationship to each other. One is the offending transgressor, the colonial power, the French. The other is the innocent victim, the Algerians, fighting for a liberation from French overlordship. Understanding when they say identity, they're not talking about kind. They're talking about relationship between transgressor and victim. And that's what you heard from that self-appointed shrew, Dr. Susan Buchanan of Oak Park.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, the climate eschatologists, have a new target. Cheryl Kroll will be happy to hear this. Toilet paper. Charmin toilet paper, to be specific.
Oh, okay.
More than 150 groups. How do you even get these people organized around toilet? More than 150 groups are pushing Procter & Gamble, maker of Charmin toilet paper, and Bounty paper towels to use recycled materials in its products. Currently, neither of those products uses recycled paper. And about one-third of it is sourced from Canadian's boreal forest, a large swath of virgin forest that rings the Arctic Circle. It's just unacceptable that a company like P&G is making toilet paper, a product that is used for seconds and flushed from virgin pulp, said Shelley Vineyard, pun intended, boreal corporate campaign manager for the Natural Resources Defense Council. By the way, virgin pulp, that was the name
of what band?
That was the name of my high school garage band. We were a Sex Pistols tribute band.
Oh, yeah. That's
you should
right.
have seen the Johnny Rotten I did. Yeah. Fantastic.
Well, I don't use Charmin because it clogs my toilets. It's too thick.
Probably we should go the way of red meat here, which is recycling as an intermediate step to banning altogether, just as we're going to increase taxes on red meat as an intermediate step to mandating Americans change their diet. And even though red meat is now found to not necessarily have any impact on the incidence of heart disease, still needs to be eradicated from our diet. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. For more on this topic, from a sort of a useful operator's guide to knowing when you're being buffaloed by agitprop as opposed to science, we're pleased to be joined by Jay Richards. He's executive editor of The Stream, thestream.org. He's also an assistant research professor in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. Jay, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. So when we have the story du jour of what should be banned and how else we need to alter our lives, how else we need to regress back to a bygone epoch in order to save the planet, how should we understand the debate is over, 99% of scientists agree, when we also hear, I don't know, like the other week, 500 scientists submitting a video and a letter to the UN saying we don't agree?
I mean, here's the problem is that we can't all study climate science, right? And so this is sort of a dilemma that people feel like, well, what can I do but trust this supposed consensus? And I argue in this piece, science disguised as science, or politics disguised as science, that what you do is you look at the way the supposed consensus develops. So look at the sociological details. Does it look like it's the result of a bunch of scientists independently and dispassionately looking at the evidence? Or does it look like a large political campaign in which dissenters tend to get punished? In fact, one of the kind of 12 indications that I give is actually when you hear all the time about a consensus, when there's actually a genuine consensus on a scientific question, you don't hear about the consensus on gravity or general relativity. you hear about the consensus on climate change, and then if you dig into it, it's not just, you know, a consensus that the climate is changing or that we're in a warming trend or maybe that we're partially contributing to it, but it's this claim of catastrophe that if we don't basically rework the global economy right now, we're going to have this runaway greenhouse effect and we're going to destroy a life on the planet. There's no consensus on that. In fact, there's no evidence on that. And so it really just kind of separating out these questions in your mind is, I would say, the kind of first thing you want to do in trying to decide, okay, is this a consensus that was genuinely formed that I should trust, or is this really more politics and groupthink?
One of the other examples that are sort of embedded in a couple of your 12 easy steps to peruse and apply is sort of just when scientists say we don't need to use the scientific method here. It's sort of the irony lost on them.
No, it is. I mean, this is what's sort of odd about it is people have all of these numbers in their heads. People have heard 97% of scientists, you know, agree on the climate change issue. And you dig into it, it's simply not true. But what you actually see is not scientific arguments, but these sort of ad hoc or ad hominem attacks against dissenters. So the dissenters are called, you know, climate deniers. I mean, people like Richard Lenson, who's a prominent meteorologist at MIT, who says, look, you know, we're getting completely crazy on this subject. Well, he's called a climate denier. These are not sort of fringe cranks with, you know, tinfoil hats on their heads talking about this stuff. This is people saying, look, the computer models that we're relying on for a lot of these projections predict twice the rate of warming that our actual satellites are detecting. And so there's just a mismatch between theoretical prediction and what we're actually observing scientifically. That's the thing that everybody ought to be hearing about. And instead, they're told that there's some vast conspiracy from the oil companies to perpetuate a myth. That's just not what's happening.
Well, with what they're teaching in Chicago public schools, at least that I found out, is that the world is going to end in 1,000 years, not a few or 12 years, like AOC said. And they were teaching them that there's going to be rising sea levels, landfills are going to be clogged, and that there's going to be extreme heat and extreme cold.
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Jay Richards, CPS teachers have now figured out when the world's going to end. This just in.
It's remarkable. I mean, that itself is something that we have to be suspicious of. And so when you're dealing with a science that by its very nature doesn't look like it can be all that precise, I mean, predicting the global climate 50 or 100 years out, that just doesn't sound like something on which we're going to get precision. And when you hear these precise sort of predictions, that itself, yeah, 1,000.
Can you give me 1,000,
1,000, yeah, okay, let's take it. But the thing is that nobody wants to talk about 1,000 because that doesn't require a radical kind of political solution that we have time to sort of think of a way to resolve the problem. That's why we keep getting these, you know, 12 years out, 7 years out. It's because that requires a political solution. Now, I'm not arguing that that we're not in a sort of a warming trend. I think the evidence suggests that we are in a slight warming trend. I think it's highly plausible that humans contribute to this in some way. I don't think we know exactly how much, because we can't separate the natural variation, which is sort of the noise, from the signal, which would be human activity. But we haven't established that moderate warming is even a bad thing. In fact, it might be a good thing, as the UN actually admits in its most recent report. And we certainly haven't established that any of these proposed political solutions would make any difference. In fact, all the evidence is that even if all the countries of the world, for instance, signed on to the Paris Accord, it would make virtually no difference, and it would cost trillions of dollars. And so that's why I think, you know, whatever you think about the kind of detailed scientific questions, we mainly need to look at this as a kind of massive attempt to essentially put the economy under the political control of either the United States or the United Nations.
Jay Richards, I have three words in response to that last answer. How dare you? How dare you? The shaming that goes on, too. I mean, you mentioned one of your indicators in your handy-dandy guide is ad hominem attacks replace a discussion on science. And so isn't that what we're subjected to now? As you were mentioning, an MIT professor is called a climate denier because he explains what the data says.
No, that's right. And I have gotten this. In fact, I think for a long time my name was up on a website called Exxon Secrets, even though I've never gotten a check from Exxon. I would love to receive those. I never have, actually. But and it called me a climate skeptic, which is, look, I think that we're in a warming trend. I think that it's plausible. I don't think we can prove it. It's plausible that human activities contribute to that, because we are part of nature. And so it makes sense we would have some kind of contribution. I just don't think that it's a disaster, and I don't think these so-called solutions would actually solve the problem. And for that, I get called a climate denier, which is really bizarre.
So you think we're still, like, as AOC said, we're still several years away from having to eat the babies then?
Yeah, at least a few years away. let's definitely hesitate on that one.
Yeah.
Maybe consider some other proposals ahead of time.
Just the pump. So pump the brakes on our Tesla is what you're saying on that.
Yeah, exactly. Just pump the brakes a little bit. And none of this means we shouldn't be good stewards of the environment. Nobody wants dirty air and dirty water. And in fact, if you look at the statistics in the United States in the last 40 years, we've done a really good job on that. People tend not to die of environmental pollutants. We don't die of the real killers, which is sort of insect-borne environmental pollutants. And so now we're focused on what is essentially a trace compound in the air, which is actually something we breathe out every time we take a breath, and it's plant food. So, I think that in some ways, the real environmental catastrophe has been averted over kind of rational policies in the last 40 years. And so now we're focused on this highly amorphous thing, I think mostly for political reasons.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, this is, you're getting to something that's really important. The danger with these individuals is not the, you know, replace fossil fuels with windmills in the next 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
That's not gonna happen. The danger
No.
is all of the innovation that has saved hundreds of millions of lives over the last half a century. And Bjorn Lundberg at the Copenhagen Consensus Center
Yes.
does great writing on this. Talk about how much innovation and the extension of a reliable energy to second and third world countries has improved lives and saved lives. You're talking about jeopardizing the very people you say you're in business to save.
I think that's really the key moral issue. I mean, the truth of the matter is the developed world is, we're not going to go back, to chipping rocks together. It's just not going to happen. But there are a lot of poor countries that actually still need to come online and still need to use the abundant and available and expensive energy that we enjoy. That doesn't mean we're going to be using hydrocarbons forever. Once other sources of energy are more economically efficient and make more sense, we'll switch to that for basic economic reasons. But the real effect of kind of this catastrophism is really that the third world and the developed world, which still need to get ahead, will actually be hampered from using it, just as they are hampered from using moderate uses of DDT. After we had solved the malaria problem for us, we banned it for them. That's exactly what I fear will happen with fossil fuels.
Now, Dan makes fun of me all the time because I recycle.
Well, government recycling programs that are, you know, virtue signaling without point, not actual recycling programs in the private sector that produce results.
I rinse out the glass jars. I recycle paper. I do what I can to be a good steward of Mother Earth.
She uses only
Am
one.
Am I just wasting my time?
Square of single ply toilet paper, like Sheryl Crow.
And
the corn cobs are probably the most environmentally friendly way. But I mean, look, with recycling, the basic argument is if the benefits outweigh the cost, then recycle. If they don't, then don't do it. Sometimes the amount of energy and water you use, for instance, in cleaning stuff, is more energy intensive than actually just replacing it. So things like paper, the reality is that very often recycling paper actually uses more energy, and actually produces more fossil fuels than just using other trees or something like that. And so I don't know the details with the Charmin situation, but we shouldn't just assume that every recycling procedure is actually going to save the environment. Sometimes it's actually worse, and you kind of get the devil's in the details, unfortunately.
He is Jay Richards, executive editor of The Stream, thestream.org. He's an assistant research professor in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. To check out his column on politics disguised as science, I just tweeted out at Dan Proft. Jay, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, just one note on our good Dr. Susan Buchanan, that Oak Park Village trustee who...
Such a nice little dainty lady, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, she's... just went nuclear on the city council and the village council and the mayor, the village board and the mayor, for being white men who don't understand oppression, systems of oppression. By the way, she was also talking about the Oak Park police when she was talking about a system of oppression, just so you get a feel for it. But the mayor of Oak Park is an Arab Palestinian immigrant, by the way.
Oh,
Anan Abu Talib, I think he's a local business owner. So the black and brown people that she's speaking for,
are actually black. And
she's
brown.
She's asserting that she speaks for while she's mau-mauing the Arab Palestinian mayor of Oak Park. That's how delicious left wokeness is. The champagne socialism, the strains that you see presenting themselves in the suburbs. It's really, truly something to behold.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.